It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How are missing Black women and children handled by authorities and portrayed in the media as over 600,000 people go missing each year? We learn how media reports are far more likely to seize on the disappearance of a white woman than that of a woman of color. Join in on the deep-rooted biases. What can be done in our daily lives? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ashley Luthern is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. Natalie Wilson here as well, co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation, a nonprofit with a mission to help bring awareness to missing people of color around the nation. Natalie, welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. You know, Natalie, we've been aware of missing white woman syndrome in the media for years now. You've been sounding the alarm. Can you explain the problem, how media coverage fails to report on missing people of color?
Okay. Well, you know, when we started the organization in 2008, quite frankly, we were surprised how lopsided the numbers really were as they pertain to missing people of color. 30% of all persons missing when we started were people of color. That number has now grown to 40%. And we all know the names of people like Chandra Levy, most recently Gabby Petito, and the list goes on. But if I ask any of your audience or your listeners to name a person of color that has gotten that same level of national media coverage, they can't. So what we have realized is that many times when a Black person or person of color is reported missing, they're classified as a runaway. First of all, if they're a child, therefore they do not receive the Amber Alert or any type of media coverage at all. And the perception is that they're involved with some type of criminal activity or deviant behavior. So they're getting what they deserve. And what we're trying to do is to change the narrative that these are our missing mothers and fathers, sisters, brothers, valuable members of our community.
How dangerous is the runaway label?
It's very dangerous because people don't tend to act, because the perception is this child left home voluntarily. So think about it. If you see two flyers, one says missing or one says runaway, which one would prompt you to act?
Missing.
Right? The
mm-hmm.
one that says missing. Mm-hmm. So again, we need to really take a look at the systems and the policies that are in place. Why are you labeling these children as runaways when the parents are telling you something different?
Ashley, you know, when you look at the statistic about 600,000 Americans going missing each year, of the adults and children who disappear and remain missing in Milwaukee, why are Black people less likely to be found?
I think that's a really good question that Natalie's organization does a wonderful job of highlighting cases, including cases in Milwaukee that involve long-term missings. And I did want to, I certainly agree with Natalie on the danger of the runaway label. I think that's something that my colleagues and I have been investigating and reporting on. And I do want listeners to know that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children more than a decade ago took away the runaway label, thanks to advocacy from people like Natalie, who were talking about how misinformed and how dangerous it can be to label children in that way, because runaway doesn't mean someone's not in danger. And so I just wanted to make that clear, and just to provide an update too for listeners locally. In Milwaukee, for example, the Milwaukee Police Department no longer categorizes any missing kids as runaways. They do categorize some as habitually missing if they go missing, you know, multiple times over a time period. But as far as, you know, why so many are still missing, I do think it's important to remember that most folks who are reported missing do return home, or there is an answer as to what happened to them. But for the percentage that don't, that is devastating for families. And those are cases and people and families we cannot forget about.
Ashley, in your reporting, and as you follow this, you know, since the runaway label has gone away to some respect, have you seen any shifts, any noticeable differences?
I can tell you that in our newsroom and in newsrooms across the country, there's a real emphasis on talking to families. And this is across all public safety coverage, you know, not relying on law enforcement as the primary or sole source of information. You know, there have been academic studies that have pointed out, again, as Natalie said, you know, some of the reasons for this media coverage disparity, you know, theories being, you know, the lack of racial diversity in newsrooms and media ownership. Another theory being, you know, socioeconomic status of some of these victims, you know, do they not have the resources to help, you know, devote to a publicity campaign? But then again, also this issue of media relying too much on law enforcement to kind of serve as the gatekeeper as to which cases get attention, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, in Milwaukee, for example, in the city of Milwaukee, looking at a data set from, you know, 2017 through the end of 2021, there were more than 14,300 missing persons cases filed in Milwaukee. And I say cases because some of them are repeat individuals. You know, more than 10,000 of those cases involved children age 17 or younger. Mm-hmm. Most of them did return. But I think it's, you know, it's important to make sure that we're looking at the full picture, that we're listening to families, and when families need help, that we are listening and able to try to help them as best we can. And frankly, you know, over the years, locally here in Southeast Wisconsin, we've seen families turn to social media to great effect, to advocates in our community who have large social media platforms to find their loved ones.
We're going to look at that influence in a moment. I'm going to reintroduce you, Ashley Lutheran, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Natalie Wilson, co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Natalie, I want to get some reaction to what Ashley is saying there. Not using law enforcement as a primary or sole source in the reporting, and what you think about, you know, with 14,300 cases, mostly children.
I agree. And, you know, we utilize a number of resources to confirm a case, because we receive cases from a number of platforms, whether it's the media, families, you know, so it's very important that we look at these cases carefully and ensure that they get the media coverage or the coverage that's needed, because time is of the essence with many of these cases. And it also, you know, puts pressure on law enforcement to add resources to the cases when there's that exposure. So we have to do all that we can to help these families who we are meeting at the worst points in their lives. And, you know, what we're realizing is as we're meeting with law enforcement, as well as with media outlets, we've had participated in conferences, and we're asking, you know, what is your policy? Like, how do you determine which case gets coverage, right? Mm-hmm. Or which case, how do you determine how to classify a case? And we're realizing that there is no policy in place for any of those institutions, meaning, you know, law enforcement or the media. So we're trying to change that, that narrative.
How do you give hope to families who reach out to you when the odds are stacked against them so much, whether it be through law enforcement or other types of means to get the word out about their missing loved one?
Well, we are advocates for families, and we work alongside them and hold their hands through this process so they do not give up. They can't give up. And, you know, we provide financial support. We use our expertise, whether it's media relations or, you know, with law enforcement, to help these families. And we've seen miracles happen. Right? So these families have to continue to fight and advocate for their missing loved ones, whether it's a vigil or birthday, or they have new information about the case. We have to continue to keep this, your missing loved one, in the forefront, and you cannot give up. You have to keep going, because if no one is fighting for your loved one, then who would? And you just have to keep fighting. You have to keep going.
Natalie Wilson leads the Black and Missing Foundation, raising awareness, providing resources and tools. Ashley Lutheran covers criminal justice and social issues for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Join in on the disparities, the tensions around Black and Missing, perceptions of who deserves coverage. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're reflecting on what happens when someone goes missing, why press coverage has long focused on young white women, and why a Black woman would generate a lot less coverage. Call in at 800-642-1234. Talk about the social inequalities, what can be done differently to raise awareness and address racial biases head on. We have journalist Ashley Lutheran, who is at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Natalie Wilson, co-founder and CEO of the Black and Missing Foundation. They stay with us. Ashley, you brought up social media, and I just want to go further there. How has social media helped or hindered the search for missing people?
I personally think it has helped. I think advocates like Natalie, advocates we have locally, have used social media to great effect, to raise awareness of cases, to put cases, frankly, on more traditional media radar that maybe we haven't seen because of that gatekeeping role I discussed earlier. But I wanted to highlight, I think we also live in a time where we have to pay attention to audience, right? And how these messages are being received and who is sharing and engaging with social media posts. And so my colleagues at USA Today and I took a look at social media posts from the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And we looked at that specific organization's Facebook page because they are extremely consistent with how they post information about missing children. They always include a photo. They include very similar language. So it's not as though one post gets more engagement because it has a video instead of just no image or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so there's this idea that social media, you know, could and arguably should be an equalizer for finding missing kids and highlighting kids of all backgrounds. This analysis, though, of 375 videos from the center's Facebook page found that the average views on posts about white girls, it was more than 63,000 views. And for Black girls, it was 38,000. And this is an organization that has more than a million followers. They're actually posting more videos about missing Black children than other children. But even so, posts with kids of color receive significantly fewer views. And specifically, Black girls and boys received significantly fewer views. And so there's some discussion there about, you know, is it who's following the page? Is it about, you know, who's using Facebook, even though we see similar usage groups via surveys across racial demographics? And one other point that I wanted to raise, because Natalie mentioned this, the longer a child is missing, the average number of views on the center's videos drop as the time passes. And so she's absolutely right that it's so critical to get this information out early. But that just shows, again, even when there's a concerted effort from people putting out the information to make sure that it is representative, to try to make it unbiased or to interrogate such biases before putting it out on a platform, there's still an audience, right? And part of that is just because of the culture that and sort of the society that we're all sort of swimming in, and who's using things and what captures people's attentions and some of those things. And I know Natalie had reached out after that story, and I know my colleagues have spoken to her as well. So I didn't know if she had any thoughts on that.
Yes, findings. Natalie, go ahead.
Yes, and I agree with you, Ashley. You know, social media has been a godsend for us. We don't have to wait on the traditional news cycle. We can get that information out instantaneously. And with a wide audience. And it has been successful for us. We've been able to find and reunite quite a few children because of it. But what we're also realizing is that through social media, you know, because individuals are not personally affected by it, or they may not know that missing person, they've turned a blind eye to it. So they are not sharing, they're not helping these cases to go viral. But what we're trying to do is to let people know that this is a missing, valuable member of our society. So just because you don't know the person, share it. You know, we verify every single case before we put it on our clearinghouse or share it on social media. And so does the National Center. So please help us. We need the community to be engaged to help us find these missing individuals, especially our children. We know that within 24 to 48 hours of them being on the street, they're propositioned for sex, could be victims of sex trafficking. So we need to get them, if not home, but to a safe environment.
Natalie, have you found in the pandemic that social media has also become more challenging as you tackle this issue?
Well, I will say that during the pandemic, our caseload has increased. I want to say that it has doubled.
Wow.
As far as sex trafficking cases. Mm. We're spending a lot of time online, right? Through our chat, any device that has a chat feature. Well, guess what? The predators are doing the same thing. And they're reaching out to these kids that are most vulnerable and having discussions with them and luring them to meet with them and being victims of sex trafficking. So it's something that we're working on as well.
Natalie Wilson, their co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation, Ashley Lutheran, a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, as we talk about missing people of color. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ashley, the Amber Alert system, starting in 1996, has a long history, broadcasting about children abduction cases. Has the criteria for issuing an Amber Alert disfavored children of color?
I think it's important to take a step back. So here's the criteria in Wisconsin. Wisconsin has used the Amber Alert system since 2003. I think that's important to note because one of the most high profile cases in the state stems from Milwaukee, and that's the case of Alexis Patterson. She went missing in 2002 before we were using Amber Alerts. Her case is part of the reason why the state has them. And so the criteria are that the child must be 17 years or younger, they must be in danger of serious bodily harm or death, and the initiating agency must have enough descriptive information about the child or the person suspected of taking them or the vehicle they're in to believe that an immediate broadcast will help find the child. And so, you know, we have objective criteria right there, but we're part of systems that are made up of individuals, right? And mm-hmm. So I think often what comes down to and what families and law enforcement might differ on is perhaps the level of danger or that a child might be facing. And so I think that might be where some of the disparity is coming from. And I think Amber Alerts, even though people are very well familiar with them, it's important to remember that they are quite rarely used because of the criteria. Relatively speaking, you know, we were talking about some of those large numbers of missing persons cases. And just to point out, from 2003 through, you know, July of 2020, Wisconsin had issued 41 alerts. 18 of them were for Black children, 15 were for white children, and the other 8 were for children of other races and ethnicities. And then last year in 2021, there were 11. And a lot of those ended up being linked to domestic violence. And so you're seeing just a relatively small percentage of cases. And then when they do get those Amber Alerts, it is important because nationally, you know, most mm-hmm. Amber Alerts do result in a child being found within 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And it's also important to remember that, you know, more than 60% of Amber Alerts nationally do involve some sort of parental abduction. And so I think people have a lot of the public might have a lot of perceptions when they see that alert on their phone mm-hmm. about what's going on, a child likely thinking like a child's been kidnapped, something like that. And often these situations do involve, you know, could involve parents, could involve domestic violence. And so regardless, it's critical to take those seriously.
And pay attention to them. Natalie, we're really short on time. Last word here. How can people change, be more proactive? What can we do differently in our lives?
Well, Again, education is key. Talking to our children about the dangers of social media, and being careful what is being shared on the social media platforms. But most importantly, you know, all of us play a role in finding and bringing home our missing, and that includes the media, law enforcement, and the community. So if we all continue to work together, and when you see a post on social media, don't turn a blind eye to it and realize that these are missing mothers, fathers, children, valuable members of our community. And it could be you.
It could be you.
Someone to act.
Family. Yes. Thank you both for joining us. That was Natalie Wilson, co-founder of the Black and Missing Foundation. Ashley Lutheran, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn now about a Pfizer clinical trial underway for a Lyme disease vaccine, with Marshfield Clinic Research Institute taking part. Bring your questions about tick bites, spreading Lyme disease, your thoughts on the potential for a preventative vaccine, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Matt Hall is an infectious disease specialist and researcher at Marshfield Clinic. Dr. Hall, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, looking at the CDC numbers, estimating 476,000 people are diagnosed with Lyme disease each year. What does the future look like for a Lyme disease preventative vaccine?
The vaccine world for Lyme disease goes back about a decade. There was a previously approved vaccine that was taken off the market. Pfizer has stepped in the last couple of years with a hope to develop another vaccine that could get approval and then access for people to have in the areas that have Lyme disease.
When could a vaccine be available to the public? What is the state of the research?
Well, this is a phase three trial. People are probably a little more familiar with the FDA lingo about phases. So it's completed the early stages for safety and then progressed into the studies that look at whether it works or not, and also continue to look at the safety of it. It's probably a couple years away still. Vaccines do not get on the market like they did for COVID within weeks. It literally takes years. So my guess is probably a couple years to go, at least, probably could be 5 years.
Can you explain more about what Pfizer is studying with the vaccine, the parameters of it, what it's testing?
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a question. We could talk for a long time about it. Basically, like all vaccines, it wants to prevent disease, and then if not prevent, lessen disease. The population, the interesting about this study is it does involve not just adult people, but also children, which is a little bit of that's a tough thing to do when you do these studies, is to open it up to a wide range of ages, but Pfizer's done that.
Why is that difficult?
Well, I mean, part of it is just managing these studies. They're a huge management team. I mean, we're doing this study here in central northern Wisconsin via the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute, but it's actually a worldwide study. I mean, Lyme disease occurs in Europe, and in the United States, a large portion of Lyme disease is actually in the northeast New England area. So, I mean, they have to coordinate a number of sites to get the study done. It just increases the complexity when you're using, age groups that range that far. And so it just makes a logistic issue kind of for the study to do it. You just add on that many more enrollees and people that need to be followed for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing. So you asked kind of about the study. It's, this study, you have to enroll, get people in, get them vaccinated, and then you need to follow them. And then you have to have a certain number actually be exposed to the illness. And this is a placebo trial, so we don't know if this vaccine actually works or not. So there, you have to compare it to people not getting the vaccine. So over the next couple of years or more, we have to have people get vaccinated, get out and get exposed, and then some of them need to get Lyme disease to show that the vaccine actually works. And so these studies, actually clinical trials for things, including vaccines, are actually big undertakings.
Mm. Can you explain what the Pfizer trial vaccine does inside the body, how it could conceivably prevent Lyme disease?
Yeah, that's kind of a cool question. And that's the thing about Lyme disease. It's a difficult illness in some ways, for people that get the illness, but it actually is kind of a fascinating disease on the other hand. And so actually the vaccine doesn't work in the person. So when you get Lyme disease, it's a deer tick that attaches, has a blood meal, and the bacteria that's called Borrelia is in the gut of the tick, and actually changes genetically to live in the gut of the tick to live in the body of the person or deer or mouse. It's not limited to just, or dogs, it's not just limited to people, but it has to change genetically. And so what actually this vaccine does is the people, we produce antibodies that actually travel into the gut of the tick having the blood meal, and actually that's where the prevention actually occurs. So it's actually kind of interesting to think about that actually the bacteria would never actually make it into the person. The vaccine, the antibodies, hopefully that we would produce adequately to attack the Borrelia, but that attack would occur in the gut of the tick.
Yeah, the tick itself. That it's like such a different approach, because you always think of the prevention coming, right, on the other side once the transfer has occurred.
Now that there is analogies to this, that's why I like infectious disease, because I'm kind of an analogy kind of person. We do have we have one influenza vaccine, which is a nasal spray, and that kind of has the same idea, that we produce antibodies that are on the surface of the mucous membranes of the respiratory tract, and that's where you would prevent maybe influenza getting in. And that's what they've done for a couple COVID vaccines. I don't want to get too far off. The reason I love infectious disease is because we can go anywhere. Well, right now the Chinese are trying to use vaccines that actually are nasal sprays and inhaled for COVID. So the cool thing about this Lyme disease one is that actually the antibodies produced would be to the Borrelia while it's still in the foregut. Now, the one difference between it and the previous one is that the other thing about the antibodies and immunizations vaccines we don't really sometimes consider is that we don't make just an antibody to something. We make antibodies, literally. Wow. Yeah, there's tons of them that the body actually makes when a natural infection occurs. During vaccines, it's a little different. Sometimes it's to a single antigen, but this vaccine does have six antigens, which I think the theory behind it is that you get a more robust immune response and maybe a better vaccination if you do that. So that's the one, that's probably the primary difference between that and the previous one, is the number of antigens and then antibodies the body would produce.
I'm going to reintroduce you here, Dr. Matt Hall, with us as we talk about a Lyme disease vaccine in the future, in the trial stages at Marshfield Clinic Research Institute, and a worldwide trial at that. Dr. Hall is a Marshfield Clinic infectious disease physician and researcher. You can join in on Lyme disease, 800-642-1234. Let's talk a bit about the previous vaccine. In the 90s, the FDA approved a different Lyme disease vaccine that was 80% effective. And then a few years later, the company takes it off the market. What happened?
Well, we're not totally sure, because this was a decision made at the company that had the vaccine at their, I guess, board level kind of thing. I think there probably was multiple reasons why. One is it may not be it may not be as good a business model as they thought it would be. I mean, the one thing about the vaccine is that it is, you know, if you're in most of the country, you won't be getting this vaccine. So I think part of it was just the business model of it. The other part, though, came down to there was concern that for some infections, you have a post-infectious process, maybe an autoimmune process that might occur. You know, that's what rheumatic fever is. And for Lyme disease, we do know that occurs in some situations. And I think there was some concern vaccination may stimulate this autoimmune and then might become somewhat of a risk to the company. The thing was that would actually never occurred, you know, after the vaccine was released and then followed, including following those individuals that, you know, we still have patients that come in that we see that have gotten the vaccine well over a decade ago. And there was no untoward things happening. But I think that was we think it was some concern about, you know, the risk of a vaccine. And that's the one thing about.
It was a 3-shot series as well. Yeah. And would that be a barrier?
It's a barrier. So that's the golden vaccine is you go in and get one shot and you're protected forever and ever and ever. And
yes,
we know for most vaccines, I mean, people get their tetanus shot still a decade at a time, and that's a decade apart. So at least it's not every, you know, and then, but a lot of them have a series that requires, I mean, COVID has a series that's required. A lot of the vaccines that we get require a series of vaccines. And so for Lyme disease, that's part of the, and that's part of this study is, it's a study is the same thing. You get two of them early on, a few months apart. You know, we enrolled people starting in the early fall and then through very early winter. We're still enrolling children because it's been a little tougher enrolling them, but now they need to get another shot now. And then it's the same thing as other vaccine. There's another delayed shot later on. So it does require that series up front. And so that is a barrier to vaccines. That was a barrier to the previous vaccine because you could get people to get a shot a couple, few months apart or so, mm-hmm. but getting people back a year later for another shot, that's a much more difficult thing to do.
So. Let's bring on a question here, a caller, Darlene. Darlene, what's on your mind?
Yes, a couple of things. I would like to know, why is it that dogs have vaccines against Lyme disease and dogs have tests to rule out or rule in certain vector-borne diseases, whereas humans don't? And as far as the Lymerix vaccine, I had 2 out of the 3 series many years ago, and one of my physicians told me not to take the 3rd vaccine because he felt that it was not safe.
Hmm. Darlene, such great questions. Thank you for calling in. Dr. Hall.
I should have had one of my veterinarian friends come help me out with the first one. You know, the veterinarian medicine and human medicine are not mirror images of each other for a number of reasons. Why one, I guess, could be risk to the patient. And Lyme is not the only vaccine example where we have an animal vaccine, but not a human one. West Nile is a common illness in horses and things, and we have a vaccine for it. So that's part of it. And I really can't speak to the veterinarian world. You know, how did they get the vaccine through their regulatory things for dogs? And then as for the testing for it, we do for Lyme disease. That's one of the things about Lyme disease is that just like the rest of our world, there's sort of half things. We have good testing for later illnesses in Lyme disease. It's an antibody test. We don't actually have a good test up front because we don't have any direct detection of the germ per se for Lyme disease. But the veterinarians use the same test, basically use the same tests we do. They're just, their diagnostic algorithms may be slightly different in animals than they are in people. And then for the second question, that leads up to what we just talked about. There was this concern that there might be some untoward thing with the previous vaccine. And it was a concern at the business level of the company, but it never occurred. You know, no follow-up study has ever shown any untoward problem with that vaccine. And so it probably could have stayed on the market, at least from a safety standpoint.
Let's pause right here with infectious disease physician Matt Hall with us on Lyme disease and a phase 3 clinical trial to investigate a potential vaccine. Join in with your questions about the potential for a vaccine. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Marshfield Clinic Research Institute is participating in a Pfizer clinical trial looking at the safety and efficacy of a vaccine for preventing Lyme disease. There aren't any approved vaccines for the most commonly reported vector-borne disease in our country. Dr. Matt Hall is a Marshfield Clinic infectious disease physician and stays with us. Let's take another call. Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi. What's on your mind?
Well, this question, I hope, will not be regarded as so cynical or silly as it may sound, but I'm interested in what is expected in the control group behaviors, because right now I can tell you that a person who is aware and uses preventive sprays and wears garments that are tight at the wrist and tight at the ankle, and inspects one's body, you know, after being out in the grass and bushes and trees and stuff, which some of us are in all the time, greatly, greatly reduces the possibility of ever getting Lyme disease.
If you use all the precautions, you can probably prevent Lyme disease.
So how does the control group member get instructed or told to behave? I can't imagine the scientific community saying, just go out in your shorts and your t-shirts and see if you can pick up ticks.
Let's hear from Dr. Hall. Dr. Hall, go ahead.
No, Rich, that's not a silly question. It is actually a great question. So from the study from the study part of it, what we tell people is do the same thing you did for the last 5 years, 10 years, or whatever, do that for the next 5 to 10 years. We don't instruct them in anything different. We want them to do what they've been doing. And so, and it's an interesting, it comes down to public health, and then physicians at an individual patient level tell people to do lots of things. But you know, people don't always listen to public health or to their providers. And so, and Rich has a great, I mean, it's the part that's really good about the question is that it is true that we make these recommendations. We actually don't know how well those preventive things work. They seem like they would, but no one's ever done that study that Rich is actually saying, telling one group, go out there and go in shorts and never look for ticks and get as much exposure as you can and see what happens. And then another group say, hey, you know, wear long pants, you know, pull your socks up over your pants to your knees and put permethrin on all your clothes and things like that. And we've never done that study. It seems obvious that it would work, but we don't know. But yeah, for the study though, we tell people don't change anything. Now you live your life just like you did previously. We want this to be, we want the only change to be in the group of the study as a whole is the vaccine. We don't want behavior changes to make, you know, any impact.
Well, let's hypothetical here. Let's say the vaccine works. It gets approved by the FDA. If you would get the vaccine, would you ever have to worry about tick bites again, or are there still other concerns?
That's a great question too. So like you said, sort of the previous vaccine didn't completely eliminate the risk for Lyme disease. So we have some really good vaccines, and some of them really close to doing that, but no vaccine, nobody can tell you you're not going to get an illness after you get vaccinated. That's one. And then you're right. Tick, we have this tick-borne illness concept that, ticks transmit other things, and it's true, they do. Anaplasmosis, babesiosis, and then we do have some Powassan virus. It's a much less common one, but there are other illnesses that you would still be at risk. So we would still tell people to do tick checks and all the other things Rich mentioned.
Let's go to Martha in Menominee. Martha, what is your question?
Well, I'm that case study, Dr. Hall and Rich, that did everything, wore the long sleeve, sprayed, and I still got Lyme disease. Got it 3 times. Mm. In fact, I may end up going to an infectious disease specialist if I get it again. My question is, can I get the vaccine?
Can you enter this trial if you've had Lyme disease before? Is that what you're asking?
Yes.
Yeah, so, and that's a tricky thing. And that's an example how tricky these clinical trials are. The sponsor of the company with the proposed vaccine works with the FDA and then decides the nuts and bolts of a trial. And so that's what they had to do with the situations where people have had previous Lyme disease. So, and this is why Lyme disease from my side of the world is very fascinating. And as a person that goes outdoors and gets Lyme disease, it's troubling, but for me, it's fascinating. So if people get Lyme disease, the tick attaches, transmits to Borrelia, they get the rash or the acute illness and they get treated right away, they may not form antibodies to be protected and they can get Lyme disease again. Usually it's the rash, erythema migrans. I've seen patients, we have published studies about this, that they're new disease, new illnesses, new infections. So it can happen again. And someone like that would be available for the study. Now, if someone's had, a form of Lyme disease that follows the acute infection, what we would group in the people that have arthritis or a neurologic disease or carditis, those patients would not be included. And so it's a little bit tricky for the enrollment. It's actually been my major role in this study. We have an army of nurses and coordinators and things that run the study, but mine has actually been being sure that we don't include those people that have had like Lyme arthritis in the past. So when someone says they've had Lyme disease, it takes getting the information from them to determine whether it was acute Lyme disease that resolved with treatment or if they had one of these more complicated prolonged
situations.
Illnesses.
Yes. Dr. Hall, thank you for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Dr. Matt Hall is a Marshfield Clinic infectious disease physician. We have a link to the vaccine trial through the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute site. Find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.